The typical reply to this argument, if one is forthcoming at all, is that Alexander Hamilton had a different view of the General Welfare Clause. Indeed he did, but what does that prove? Hamilton was dramatically out of step with most of the other delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He was also inconsistent in his views, saying one thing before the Constitution was ratified and another after ratification. In his 1791 report on manufacturers, he denied that the spending authority of Congress was confined to the powers enumerated in Article 1, Section 8, laying out a broad array of areas he wanted to see receive government funding, precisely the areas he denied the national government would have jurisdiction over when he wrote Federalist No. 17 and Federalist No. 34 several years earlier. Patrick Henry raised precisely this concern as the ratification of the Constitution was being debated in Virginia. Wasn't general welfare a dangerously open-ended phrase that would permit the federal government to do whatever it wanted, since government officials could blandly claim that all its measures were intended to promote the general welfare? Supporters of the Constitution gave Henry a definitive answer. No. General welfare did not and could not have such a broad meaning. Now, isn't our Constitution a living document that evolves in accordance with experience and changing times, as we're so often told? No, 1,000 times no. If we feel the need to change our Constitution, we are free to amend it. In 1817, James Madison reminded Congress that the framers had marked out in the Constitution itself a safe and practicable mode of improving it as experience might suggest, a reference to the amendment process. But that is not what advocates of a so-called living Constitution have in mind. They favor a system in which the federal government, and in particular the federal courts, are at liberty, even in the absence of any amendment, to interpret the Constitution altogether differently from how it was understood by those who drafted it and those who voted to ratify it. Leave aside the alleged problem of determining exactly what the framers intended by this or that constitutional clause, supporters of the living Constitution must be able to figure out the original intent well enough if they are so sure we need to evolve away from it. If the people agreed to a particular understanding of the Constitution, and over the course of the intervening years they have performed no official act, such as amending the Constitution in accordance with their evolved ideas, reversing that original understanding, by what right may government unilaterally change the terms of its contract with the people, interpreting its words to mean something very different from what the American people had all along been told they meant? A living Constitution is just the thing any government would be delighted to have, for whenever the people complain that their Constitution has been violated, the government can trot out its judges to inform the people that they've simply misunderstood. The Constitution, you see, has merely evolved with the times. Thus, as in Orwell's Animal Farm, no animal shall sleep in a bed because no animal shall sleep in a bed with sheets. No animal shall drink alcohol becomes no animal shall drink alcohol to excess, and no animal shall kill any other animal becomes no animal shall kill any other animal without cause. That's why on this issue, I agree with historian Kevin Gutzman, who says that those who would give us a living constitution are actually giving us a dead constitution, since such a thing is completely unable to protect us against the encroachments of government power. During my public life, I have earned the nickname Dr. No, a reference to my previous occupation as a physician combined with my willingness to stand against the entire Congress, if necessary, to vote no on some proposed measure. I am told I have been the sole no vote in Congress more often than all other members of Congress put together. As a matter of fact, I don't especially care for this nickname, since it may give people the impression that I am a contrarian for its own sake, and that for some reason I simply relish saying no. In those no votes, as in all my congressional votes, I have thought of myself as saying yes to the Constitution and to freedom. The Constitution has much to say to us regarding foreign policy, if we will only listen. For over half a century, the two major parties have done their best to ignore what it has to say, especially when it comes to the initiation of hostilities. Both parties have allowed the President to exercise powers of which the framers of the Constitution thought they had deprived him. And since both parties have been contemptuous of the Constitution's allocation of war powers between the President and Congress, neither one, with very rare exceptions, ever calls the other out on it. The framers did not want the American president to resemble the British king, from whom they had separated just a few years earlier. Even Alexander Hamilton, who was known to be sympathetic toward the British model, was at pains in the Federalist Papers to point out a critical difference between the king and the president as envisioned by the Constitution. The president is to be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. In this respect, his authority would be nominally the same with that of the King of Great Britain, but in substance, much inferior to it. It would amount to nothing more than the supreme command and direction of the military and naval forces as first general and admiral of the Confederacy, while that of the British King extends to the declaring of war and to the raising and regulating of fleets and armies, all of which by the Constitution under consideration would appertain to the legislature.